Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Genetics, neuroscience, and immunology are perhaps the three areas that have recently provided the greatest leaps forward in our understanding of human biology. Today, we're going to take a closer look at recent advances in neuroscience. My guest today is Dr. Virginia Campbell. She's the producer of the podcast Brain Science and Books and Ideas, as well as a practicing emergency physician in Alabama. She's been a biomedical engineer, or maybe she still is a biomedical engineer, and she's a tennis and golden retriever aficionado. Dr. Campbell, welcome to Line One.
Thanks for having me on, Thad.
I have, I can't remember when I stumbled onto Brain Science. I'm constantly listening to brain, to podcasts, trying to I'm fishing for stories. I'm fishing for people to interview and so forth. And it is just a real treat to listen to Brain Science. And I've gone back and listened to some of them in preparation for today's show as well. So congratulations on doing that.
Well, thanks. It's lots of fun. I get to interact with people from all over the world, which is really fun.
Yeah, it's amazing who you can get on the telephone and start talking to nowadays.
Yeah, thanks to Skype, you can interview people from Europe and everything. It's really... And I don't even need a radio station to podcast.
That's true. Yeah, I'm not sure we're really a podcast. We're a radio program that does some podcasting. We're a little different. Well, why did you get into podcasting? What led you there from... you intentionally got into this. I kind of stumbled into it.
Well, I bought my first iPod back in 2003 to listen to audiobooks, and when iTunes put podcasting onto iTunes in the summer of 2005, I started listening. As soon as I had listened a little while, I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do. I had been looking sort of unofficially for something I could do that was leading edge, you might say. And also, I was looking for a way to be a part of a community, and in the early days of podcasting, it really did have a little bit more of a community feel than it does now. And so it took me a year to come up with the idea for my show, and another 6 months to get my website and everything together, but I guess I'm a ham.
Were you interested in, being a ham or being on stage and so forth, it makes some sense. I understand that. But I'm always interested, is it education? Is it a drive to help people understand what's going on or maybe just being a ham?
Well, I intentionally chose not to do a straight medicine show because I didn't want to get into the self-help business. I mean, mm-hmm. We do enough of that in our regular jobs, and I didn't want that kind of a podcast. The reason that I picked neuroscience, which I think you might be indirectly asking me, is that I had been doing a lot of, I'm a person who reads and reads and reads, and I had really gotten into interested in Western philosophy, and I started reading about philosophy of the mind, and I realized that now questions like consciousness that once were the realm of philosophy are now becoming the realm of neuroscience, and that led me back to reading in neuroscience, and I had the opportunity to do a little sort of guest spot on somebody else's podcast, and once I had done that, I was like, this is a great topic. I'll never run out of stuff. I mean, there's always something new happening. And it's a great, as far as doing it as a podcast, it's a great outlet for, the thing I like the most about being a physician is sharing things with people, explaining things to my patients. And so that skill from medicine carries over. I think I'm good at making complex ideas intelligible to regular people. And that's what I enjoy about podcasting.
Yeah.
And then I discovered that I really enjoyed interviewing interesting people. I didn't start out, at first I was afraid to do an interview, but once I had a few under my belt, I realized I might actually be good at this.
Yeah, I went back this morning, I was listening, and I thought I was going to listen to one of your first three with Eric Kandel on memory, and I realized, yeah, you were just talking about his book, and we haven't yet to get a Nobel Prize winner on, so I was real envious, but you didn't get
him on. I did get a Nobel Prize winner on books and ideas, but it was a physicist.
Ah, okay, all right.
I have, Dr. Kandel, I met him a couple of years ago at the big neuroscience meeting, and he said he would come on, but his schedule is so full that every time I call his secretary, I can never actually make it happen.
I have somebody that helps me do this, and she actually contacted E.O. Wilson in his lab at Harvard, but nothing ever happened from that. We thought we were close on that situation. Anyway, let's move on here. What has maybe one of the introductory ways we can get into the neuroscience? What kinds of developments have happened to allow us to really make these leaps recently in neuroscience?
Well, I guess technology is a lot to do with where we are. The development of brain scans has been a big deal because it's allowed us to study things that are happening while people are still alive. And when it comes to figuring out what's going on in the brain, having a living subject is kind of important. And there's a lot of other fancy technology in terms of electrodes and microelectrodes and all that kind of stuff. But probably the brain imaging has been a big one. For one thing, brain imaging has made it possible to document things in a way that people find really convincing. Some of the pioneers in brain plasticity, which I think is the most exciting area, they had evidence before, but nobody would pay attention to them until they could show that same evidence on a brain scan.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of things that have turned things around, it's about technology. As always in science, we're always sort of limited by what questions we can ask and what questions we can answer by where we are in our technology.
You also mentioned thing that's kind of led us to that in your discussion on Eric Kandel that I was listening to today, and that's that we've come to the recognition that we can rather effectively study simpler animals. You mentioned that Kandel was studying a giant snail, and at the time he got into it, people thought that was maybe kind of crazy, but it turned out that it wasn't a bad idea, that we're all we're related very, very closely, and we can learn a lot. And I think you brought up that point as one of the reasons that we've had an advance back in that podcast that you did.
Yeah, and that was something that Dr. Kandel did a great job with in his book, In Search of Memory. It's a very good overview of the history of at least the study of memory and a lot of basic history of neuroscience in his autobiography. And before Kandel's work and the work of his colleagues, many people expected that the nervous system of say, mammals would be very different from the nervous system of an invertebrate. But it turns out that they're much more similar than they are different. Now that we know that our genetic code is also incredibly similar, we have at least 50% of the same genes as the little roundworm C. elegans. Now that we know that, it kind of now doesn't seem like a strange idea. But back before the genome project, the idea that we had that much in common with simpler organisms was it came as a surprise, I think, to the researchers when they realized that the same action potentials or nerve signals that happen in a snail happen in a person. And that, you're right, is a big one for being able to study how brains work. I mean, we learn a lot about what our brain does by studying mice.
Yeah, it's truly remarkable how much we're identical and how that really redocuments, again, the importance of evolution. And as strange and as hard to believe as it may be, that you can just watch things march down, both genetically and structurally through millions and millions of years.
And the thing that's really different about the nervous system and the brain is the brain is probably the only organ that we have that really kind of has our evolutionary history right there for us to see. I mean, for example, we have parts of our brain that are pretty much the same as very simple vertebrates, parts of our brain that we only share with other mammals, parts of our brain that we only share with other primates. So although brain evolution, unfortunately, the study of it doesn't get much funding, it's really a big area for understanding both what we have in common with other animals and what we have that's different. I interviewed somebody pretty recently, and I'm blanking on who it was right now, that made that point of how the brain is the only organ that really, you know, still has the layers there for us to look at.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. And we have some differences in our brains that no one else has.
Yeah, it's starting to look like we might have a few differences, but still our brains are very, very similar to those of other primates, you know, other than the fact that we got lots more cortex.
Yeah, well, maybe I misspoke, and I was thinking that some of the structural, certainly the size is bigger, but I was thinking there was some structural difference. But I am not the neuroscience specialist you are, so I'll defer to your comments on that one. I think I may have spoken out of turn. Well, let me go ahead and have our listeners understand where we're moving today. I'd asked Dr. Campbell to discuss some recent discoveries, and she gave me five, and we're going to try to get through those. One is brain plasticity and what that means, the importance of unconscious processes, the role of emotions, for example, in decision-making and addiction, mirror neurons, and the impact of neurology. So if you have questions or comments, particularly about those areas today, you can give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And we also take emails at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all spelled out, at kska.org. All right, so let's start. Brain plasticity. What are we talking about there?
Okay. Of course, the basic idea is pretty simple. It's the idea that our brains can change, that they aren't hardwired. And for people who want to learn more, I highly recommend Dr. Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself. It's a very good overview. But this may seem obvious, since you can remember, make new memories, that your brain must be plastic. But most of us who came along more than 10 years ago through college or medical school or whatever were basically taught things like, you are born with all the neurons you will ever have. And so it was quite revolutionary when it was proved, I guess, about 10, 15 years ago, that you can actually get new neurons in a few parts of the brain, the hippocampus, which is very much important in memory, and the olfactory bulb, which is important in smell. But it turns out that there's a lot more to it than that. Anyone who's ever looked at a picture of the brain has probably seen those famous diagrams that show how certain parts of the brain, there are these maps that show certain parts of the brain get the sensation from various parts of your body, and certain parts of your brain control the motor function of various parts of your body. Those are called maps. Those are constantly changing, and even under normal circumstances, those are constantly changing. So, for example, if you, and this is a famous experiment, if you practice the violin over a long period of time, they can actually show that the area of the brain that controls the fingers of your left hand gets bigger. So that's what brain plasticity means. Do you want me to keep on, or do you want to
ask? Yeah, go ahead. We have a phone call a gentleman that's holding right now. He wants to talk about emotions, but I want to hang on with one idea, and then if we get a good place, I'll bring him on and let him ask his question. But let's stay where we are.
Okay, because I'm not very experienced with being on a call-in radio show. I'm not very experienced at being the person being interviewed. I'm usually doing the interviewing. The most important thing, well, not a important thing, is that the cortical areas of our brain can actually take on new functions. For example, the part of your brain that does hearing is called the auditory cortex, and it's been shown in experiments. They did this experiment, excuse me for the infamous they. Scientists did an experiment with ferrets where they showed that they basically took these babies, ferrets, and they took their optic nerve, which is the nerve from the eye, and they connected it to the auditory cortex, which is the part of the brain for hearing, and the ferrets were actually able to see, although they didn't have 20/20 vision. Hmm. We also know that blind people use the visual cortex to read Braille. And the reason that this is possible is that we used to think that the part of the brain for vision was very different from the part of the brain for hearing, and the part of the brain for touch was very different. But it actually turns out that all the various areas of the outer brain called the cortex are identical from a functional and structural point of view. What they do is determined by who they're connected to. So the key idea is, if your visual cortex is getting information from someplace else, it will do something different. And when blind people aren't getting any kind of visual input, the visual cortex doesn't just sit there. It takes on different tasks, mostly having to do with hearing and touch. But one thing that I think is really surprising about this whole thing is that it comes on in different time scales. So, for example, when a person's learning how to do Braille, this is from an experiment by a doctor named Pascal Lyon. They did these scans to see what part of the brain, how the brain was changing, and they noticed that they would be training them all week long from, say, Monday to Friday. They would do transcranial magnetic stimulation for this. But anyway, they found that on Friday there would be changes that would have been disappeared by Monday. In other words, you know, like when you're learning something new, you feel like at the end of the week you've really got it, and then you take a few days off and you lose some of it. Mm-hmm. And then it took about 6 months before the changes became more permanent. So I bring this up because I want to make this information practical. The idea here I want to share is that when you're learning something new, you're not going to acquire that skill instantly, but you can. Mm. They also did an experiment, the same Pascal Lyon did an experiment with people who could see. He put them in very dark blindfolds constantly for about 5 days, and within just a few days, their visual cortex was already processing sound and touch. Hmm. Now, the reason that this is significant is that a few days is too fast to make new pathways. You couldn't have made new synapses, new pathways. It implies that there have to already be some connections there that we aren't using.
Right.
That's really important if you're thinking about doing rehabilitation.
Right. Right, and so injury, aging are things that come to mind real quickly about how to take advantage of this.
The most well-known example of this is Dr. Edward Taub, who is at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and he has developed something called constraint-induced movement therapy, which is a very new way of doing stroke rehab. And the difference is that what he does is he has patients constrain their good limb and forcing them to use their one that doesn't work from the stroke. And he's getting amazing results. And brain scanning shows that other parts of the cortex are taking up the work, which is something that they used to think you couldn't do. They basically used to think, and this is the idea, they thought, well, you have this part that's supposed to control your arm, and if that part's damaged,
that's it.
Too bad.
Yeah.
That's it. But that's just not true. It turns out that the cortex, which is the part that does most of this high-level control, is able to learn how to do new things. It's able to take on new tasks. If a part of the cortex isn't getting its normal signals, it will probably get different signals instead. It's kind of like a competitive thing, which means that whatever you spend your time doing, that's what your cortex is going to get wired for.
Ginger,
I must say one other thing before you ask me.
Okay.
In order for this to work, it requires that the person be really focused on the thing that they're doing. Mm-hmm. You can't, you know, do this, you know, like in your sleep with like somebody putting you on some kind of magical stimulator. Actual attention is required.
This is fascinating, and I want to stay with it, but I also think I should go ahead and I'm going to take our phone call and see what Andrew has to do, and then we'll come back to that depending on where this all leads us. Andrew, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I had a question specifically regarding emotions and, like, neurochemicals. I was wondering if we know enough that neurochemicals and emotions have a one-to-one sort of correspondence. Like, you can take sadness and say that sadness is a specific type of neurotransmitter or a combination of neurotransmitters that gets released and floods the brain, and that's part of why we feel sadness. Or if we know enough about mood and how it relates to how the brain works, that create those ratios.
So is there a one-to-one correlation between what we define as different moods or emotions and known neurotransmitters, for example?
Right.
Okie doke. All right. We'll see what Ginger
has. Well, that's actually a little bit of a controversy. My answer would be no. And the reason is that almost every neurotransmitter or other kind of protein or chemical in the body that is used in the nervous system has more than one function. So it's not so much about which transmitter is released as it is about where it's released and who it's talking to. So there is work by researcher named Jock Panksepp that shows that we have some basic circuitry in our brain for the various basic emotions, and some of these circuits are associated with specific neurotransmitters, but it's not really as simple as, oh, you're sad, you need more dopamine.
Okay.
That's one reason why just taking medication to, say, up one of them is not that simple.
That answer your question, Andrew, or you got more?
That does. I guess I would ask if it's not one-to-one, do we know sort of more about what causes these sort of moods, and are there specific areas of the brain that lights up when we're experiencing emotions or that kind of thing?
Okay.
Yes, absolutely, we do.
Let's why don't we go ahead and answer that specific part, because you had wanted to talk about emotions to some degree. Andrew, I'll ask you to kind of take the rest of this offline, and we'll kind of just briefly address this, and then we may have plenty of time to come back to some more issues as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
So as far as about the role of emotions, one of the things that I think is really important, and I've devoted several podcasts to, is the role of emotions. Well, first of all, it's important to know that emotions are part of what our brain does, that emotions do happen in the brain. There are bodily components, but the emotions are in the brain. So it turns out, first of all, that these emotions are a vital part of not only who we are as people, but in terms of making decisions. Antonio Damasio is a very well-known writer and neurologist who has shown basically that patients that don't have normal emotions also, because of brain damage, have a very hard time making decisions. That part of our decision-making process, even though it may be at an unconscious level, involves how we feel about various things. So, feeling motivated to go and do something, which is part of emotions, it kind of is what makes our lives not only worthwhile, but makes us get up in the morning. And most of that is, of course, outside of our conscious awareness. Addiction is a really big one, because we now know that there's circuits in the brain that involve I don't want to use reward circuits, because that's probably an oversimplification, but circuits that give us make us feel good when we do something that we had a success at. And it looks like with addiction that those circuits, those reward-type circuits, are being sort of hijacked when a person is affected by addiction, so that the most rewarding behavior in their life becomes getting their drug or doing whatever it is they're addicted to. You can actually be addicted to activities, too. It's all around the same, stimulating those particular circuits in the brain, abnormally, I guess you could say. There's also people looking into whether or not perhaps people that are more addiction-prone might have problems either with lack of receptors or too many receptors or whatever. But that kind of research is still very much at an early stage. We have such a big tendency when we learn about something to oversimplify it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was in medical school in the early 80s that the idea was that depression was a lack of certain neurotransmitters. And you know that's driven the huge pharmaceutical market for antidepressants. However, the actual science has moved beyond that, and we know that it's not that simple. It's not keeping the drug companies from mm-hmm. marketing the drugs the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to emphasize the fact that there's no, you know, simple shortcuts at this point. Our understanding of this is still relatively primitive. So the main thing to think is to know is that emotions are a normal part. You know, there was a time, I guess, during the Enlightenment when people thought, well, if we could just make totally rational decisions that mm-hmm. had no emotions involved, that this would be ideal. Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually not possible.
I'm struggling with this idea of how much conscious control is over the control of the emotions. For example, we hear that if we were to just get up and think positive thoughts, we have a better day and we think more positively. But then you made me think more about that. It may not be true as opposed to addiction, so that we may not be able to control our addictions consciously as well. And then my mind went to, well, my mom and dad were smokers for 30 years, 3 packs a day. One of them got a smoking-related cancer and both stopped on one day, suggesting again that either emotions or our consciousness can overwhelm our emotions somewhat.
Yeah, and I guess that gets back to the complexity of the problem.
Right.
And yeah, yep. I mean, some people smoke for three packs a day for years and can quit. Yep. Other people really, you know, can't. And so, it again shows that our understanding of how it all works is still very primitive. In the case of smoking, I know that they've had some research recently that seems to indicate that the nicotine actually kind of tells our brain, hey, the act of smoking is a really pleasing thing to do beyond the drug effect.
Mm.
And that's mm-hmm. why some people, you know, they miss the physical mm-hmm. doing of it. Mm-hmm. And to those of us who don't smoke, that just doesn't seem to mm-hmm. make any sense. As a non-smoker, when I see someone in a car smoking, to me it's like the most disgusting thing ever.
Right.
But obviously it doesn't feel that way if you're a smoker.
Mm-hmm. Well, eating you could look at almost in the same way. Many of us may understand that better, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
All right. I think we're going to go ahead and we're moving very fast. I want to get back to the brain plasticity. We need to take one short break, Dr. Campbell, and we'll be back in just a minute. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Virginia Campbell, and we're talking about recent discoveries in neuroscience. We'll see you back in just a short period of time.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line One, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line One will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're speaking with Dr. Virginia Campbell. She's the producer of the podcast Brain Science and Books and Ideas, and we're focusing on some recent advances in neuroscience. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us at line1@kska.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433, and we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, we rebroadcast this program each Monday night at 8 o'clock. And so between 8 and 9 local time, we will not be here to answer your questions. But please feel free to go to the KSKA.org at any time if you want to listen to podcasts that we've done in the past or re-listen to today's program. Dr. Campbell, let's get back to the brain plasticity. You've mentioned that what we're discovering is these neurons that are already present in some areas of the brain, we're forming new ones, and we're realizing that they're not just there to do one thing. They may take up new functions if some functions are lost. And we've mentioned just briefly that injury is an area, rehabilitation of neurological injuries is one area where that may be important. Are there other important aspects of this that we should mention? I know aging comes to my mind, that we think about, you know, we're just going to inevitably age and there's nothing we can do to prevent some of the changes that happen with aging. But the plasticity, to me, seems to suggest that certainly is not true.
Absolutely. I think that that's a good way to go with that. I wanted to say something just about for everybody, not just people that might think that be old enough to think about aging. I think that brain plasticity is exciting because it has implications for almost everything that we do. Not only does it offer a new hope for people with a wide variety of problems, but it also offers the possibility of new approaches to learning for people of all ages. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how your listeners can tap into their brain's plasticity. Would that be okay?
Sure. I'm writing everything down so I don't forget.
The first thing is that if you want to tap into your brain's plasticity, assuming you're not rehabbing for something, is you want to learn new skills that are challenging and preferably ones that require intense focus. Don't be afraid of learning something new. It can be fun, challenging, and good for you. Mm-hmm. But that's why I talked about before about the fact that when the people were learning the Braille, that they didn't get it all at once. It took a while. I wanted to emphasize that this brain plasticity is also the reason why we don't learn new skills instantly. Some of the changes that take place in the brain take time. So when you are learning, say you're learning how to play tennis, for example, you hadn't played it as a kid, and you're learning it as an adult, you know, you might play for several days and say, hey, I'm really getting the hang of it. Take a few days off and say, gosh, I feel like I've forgotten half of what I learned. It takes a while for the new skills to really get solidly acquired. In fact, this has an overlap with the unconscious aspects of things, because when we learn a new skill, eventually most of it becomes something we do without thinking, you know, like learning how to drive. You remember how hard mm-hmm. that was when you were learning?
Yep.
And now you don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. The key idea here is that you can still learn new things, but you shouldn't be discouraged if at first it seems like your improvement is disappearing and you have to learn it over again, because that's just the way brains work. The other thing is, it turns out that mental rehearsal of new skills actually changes your brain. They did an experiment where they had people learn a finger, sort of like a piano type motion, and they had a group of people practice it just thinking of doing it, and they got almost as much improvement. So if you're learning a new skill and you can't actually do it, just mm-hmm. thinking about doing it.
Visualizing yourself doing
Visualizing, I mean, the athletes have known this for a long time, but we now actually have the scientific evidence that they were right.
Mm-hmm.
So I just really want to emphasize that it's never too late to learn something new. Foreign languages are one of the things that most of us find the most difficult as adults. That is actually probably one of the best things that we can do. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of aging, obviously, the more active you are, the better it is for your brain. But the point here is it's the stuff you do that you haven't been doing for 30 years that's really the best for keeping your brain plastic. Not, you know, it's nice if you do something like crossword puzzles, for example, but if you've always done crossword puzzles, you know, that's not the way to stave off Alzheimer's disease. You know, learning something new and, you know, like going and taking a computer class, even if you're scared of computers, if there's one thing people really can do to help their brains, that's it. And the other thing is exercise. I've done separate podcasts on this subject. But one of the things that seems to stimulate brain plasticity is a factor that the brain makes. It's a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Neurotrophic means it makes neurons grow. That gets released big time when you exercise. So it turns out that exercising is good for your body and your brain and your heart. And it makes you feel good.
So we're talking about some preventative things that we can do to take advantage of the brain plasticity, and you've mentioned mental activity, particularly new things, and in a sense that's stimulating those neurons to do something different, to take up, and they have the plasticity to do that, and that exercise through the release of hormones or chemicals can also continue to keep those neurons functioning well. Is there some plasticity issues there too, Ginger? Related to exercise, I guess.
Yes. I guess I wasn't clear. The brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is released, is a part of what makes brain plasticity possible. It signals the neurons. As Dr. John Rady, who's an expert in this area, points out that if you look back in evolution, historically people were, you know, out on their, you know, very physically active, moving around, maybe walking many miles a day, and the only people who sat still were, you know, the people that were about to die. And so he says, if you go sit on the couch, you're basically telling your brain, hey, I'm done. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need to be, you know, keep on, getting new connections. And so that's his kind of, explanation for why the brain is so sensitive to exercise, is that we were meant to move around, not to meant to sit still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other thing that just dawned on me is people get older, and I'm getting older. I think about traveling, and it seems to me that traveling would also be beneficial in this brain plasticity standpoint, because it is teaching us new things. We're seeing new experiences. We're being forced to learn some new things and see and and to use those new experiences. Am I being too simplistic again about that, or does that make
no,
sense?
No, I think that travel is probably a great example of something that people can do that's enjoyable. Mm-hmm. You have to pick something you enjoy. I mean, you hate is just not going to get the job done.
Right.
So, yeah, traveling is great because, for example, if you travel to a country, then you have a reason for trying to learn the language, right? And like you said, you have to adapt to new and different ways of doing things. And, you know, it's a tendency as people get older and maybe it gets a little bit more difficult to travel to say, oh, I'll just stay home where I know everybody and I'm comfortable. It's a big temptation to stick with the familiar and then the more you do that, the harder it is to start to go out and do new things. I have a friend who's almost 70, who's been to 74 countries. And a couple of years ago, she went to Antarctica so she could say she'd been to all the continents. And I know that she herself says, you know, this is something that she knows really is important to her mental flexibility.
I'm a pediatrician, so we see children early in life, and we're constantly being told to find those hearing abnormalities, find those visual problems very, very early, in a sense taking advantage of this plasticity or recognizing it and preventing some longer-term problems. So it's not really necessarily also an all or none phenomenon. I mean, we can if kids have a little bit of strabismus, an inability of both eyes to focus together, they get a double vision, and some of those kids will go ahead and suppress vision in one eye, called amblyopia. So, I'm struggling with some issues. We need to recognize that and take advantage of it. Yet at the same time, sometimes our brains really end up causing some problems for ourselves too.
Yeah, I think one issue is to realize that the critical periods that we've been taught,
uh-huh.
those are real.
Okay.
Those are the times of maximal plasticity.
Okay.
And there are things that once they get wired, those wires are, you might say firmware. I wouldn't say totally hardwired, but it's more difficult to fix things outside of those critical periods. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt that it's harder to learn a foreign language as an adult, and it looks like adults really can't learn foreign languages and not end up with accents. But it doesn't mean that we still have some plasticity. The point is we can't use it as an excuse. And in terms of kids, I think the important idea is that so you miss that big, say someone didn't get treated, don't give up on the idea that some rehab might be possible.
Right.
And it depends on the type of problem, how much, new function can be achieved.
Let me go ahead and mention once again to our listeners, if you have questions or comments, particularly about the brain plasticity issue and maybe the role of emotions, which you've discussed, don't hesitate to give us a call or email us. Our email address is line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Our phone number, 550-8433 in Anchorage, 550-8433. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Well, Ginger, if you are okay with it, let's move on to the importance of unconsciousness, which you have mentioned is an issue you think is an important discovery.
Okay, well, you may have, if your listeners who watch Oprah probably have heard about at least one of the authors out there touting the importance of intuition, and this is kind of, you might say, the popular version of this idea that a lot of the decision-making that's happening in our brains happens actually before we're aware of it. In fact, it turns out sometimes that we do things and then we make up the reasons for them. But we don't think that that's what we did. And this is actually very useful to us. For example, if you're a baseball player and you're hitting a fastball, you actually have to make a decision about swinging before you really have the information at the conscious level that you need to decide. Mm-hmm. So the reason that all this decision-making is going on at the unconscious level is that it's an efficiency thing. I mean, we really, attention, despite people thinking that they can multitask and watch TV and study and listen to something all at the same time, they really can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so what our brain does is, as we learn how to do things, it pushes as much of the process down into the unconscious. I'm not talking about Freud's unconscious. I'm just talking about the fact that you don't have attentional access to it, so that you don't have to think about it while you're doing it. And so it just turns out that there's a lot more going on outside of our conscious awareness than we ever thought.
Okay. So our brains are constantly working, even if we're not consciously thinking about the fact that they're working.
Exactly. And sometimes when we think that we got an idea out of nowhere, which, a lot of times people end up with supernatural explanations for that,
right.
It's because we have been thinking about it, and while our attention goes to something else, that's why people, if you think about the great ideas in the shower and so forth that. And one interesting aspect of this was covered in a book called On Being Certain by the neurologist Robert Burton, and he pointed out that, we have this sense of knowing, and that's, how when you say you know the answer, you just feel the sense that you know something. He analyzed this and really came to the conclusion that is something that is outside of our conscious awareness. And we can't, we really don't have, and the importance of this is things outside of your conscious awareness, it's for the, to a certain extent, you can't control. And so he gave an example. This was a famous study that they did with the Challenger disaster. For younger listeners, the Challenger was the one that blew up, the shuttle that blew up on its way on the liftoff. I think it was in 86. They had some people write down their experiences on the same day that this happened, what they were feeling, where they were, what they were doing. And then 2 years later, they brought these people back and asked them, you know, what were you doing, what were you feeling? And there was a huge divergence. In other words, their memory of what they wrote down was, you know, not very accurate. But the thing that was strange was that they had the person's log, and they'd say, now, this is what you wrote, and this is what you're saying today. And the person says, well, I know that's what I wrote, but this is what really happened. I mean, their sense that their new memory was the correct one was so strong that they denied their own written record. And so it's just, it brings up a lot of big questions about I didn't even mention when putting down the list of recent things, I didn't even put down memory because that's not a really recent one. But the role of the unconscious in memory is a big one too. I think too big to really do much justice to today.
You know, what came to my mind when you were talking about this unconscious process that's always going on is attentional deficit disorder. And I've heard it discussed as it's a problem of working memory. I've heard various explanations of it. I definitely believe it's real. I definitely believe medications can help when it's right. But this idea, you could almost argue, is a person with attentional disorder is their unconscious processes are interfering with their conscious attention and therefore making it more difficult. It's classic for kids who can really do a good job of explaining is that when their attention is focused often with medication, it's a clear day and it's a stormy day without the medication. Have you ever heard or of that kind of an association, or am I getting way out there speculatively?
I haven't heard of it, but I don't know that it's not. John Rady, who I mentioned before,
is
you know, well known in the field of attention deficit disorder, and he seems to think that people that have it also have some problems with their reward circuits, where they can't really. One reason they can't stay settled is because they need extra stimulation, and I'm not sure how that. And that seems to be somewhat how the drugs work. I'm not sure how that overlaps with your idea of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how you would test that. The problem with that idea is you have to come up with a method of testing it. The idea doesn't come straight to my mind.
Yeah.
Of course, that's not why I'm not the experimental science genius.
All right, we've talked about brain plasticity. We've talked a little bit about unconsciousness. We've mentioned the role of emotions when Andrew called earlier. Is there more we should comment on the role of emotions? That was one of the bigger discoveries you think that were important.
No, I think I got the high points on that. Since we're almost out of time, I would like to say something about mirror neurons because they're really fascinating. Basically, they're just sort of what they sound like. It turns out that we have neurons in our brain that not only fire when we do something, but they fire when we watch someone else do the same thing. This was actually discovered by chance in a lab in Italy where they were working with monkeys, and they had electrodes in the monkey's brain, and they were between experiments, and one of the scientists, I think he was eating something like a ice cream cone, and they looked, and all of a sudden the electrodes were just firing off on this monkey. It was reacting to the fact that it was watching this person eat something. And so since then they've gone on and studied this in great detail and determined that that it's also present in people. And people are doing all kinds of exciting stuff with this. They think that this may be, first of all, how we understand when we watch somebody else what they're doing. It may also be part of what makes empathy possible. It may be very important for how we figure out what other people are feeling. You know, people, normal people, are very good at what really could be called mind reading. I mean, you watch a TV show, you pretty much know whether the character says anything, you know, what they're thinking, what, you know. Mm-hmm. But we take all that for granted. And these mirror neurons may be a big part of why we are able to do this. And it also, you were talking at the very beginning about the fact that our brains are somehow different from other most other animals. These mirror neurons may turn out to be the key thing that primates and humans in particular have. I don't think they've found them in any other mammals, but I could be wrong about that. If they have, they're not as prominent.
So it's kind of like you see somebody yawn and then you start yawning. You see people smile and you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same
idea? Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And who knows? I don't know if you've ever noticed how when you're talking to a patient or a parent that you tend to mirror the way they're speaking.
Yep.
And you do that without even thinking.
There's been some new studies. I remember looking at children who were born, infants, and if they were born in Germany, they were looking at their early crying and as compared to babies who were born in France, and their inflection of their crying mimicked the inflection in the language of their parents. So that they're almost, well, this may be learned or copying kind of experience, but you could tell differences in language, in crying based on the language of the parent.
Yeah, it looks like our ability to mimic is very much, very important to our ability to learn and why we learn so much better than, for example, chimpanzees do not imitate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though they're relatively smart, but they don't imitate.
Huh.
And there are people who think that that may be one of the key things that we learned how to do that helped us, you know, to become human.
Okay, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. I do have another phone call, and Peter is asking some questions about epigenetics, and that always gets my attention. Peter, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. In the rather new field of epigenetics, it seems like that outside influences can change the way genes are expressed. And I wonder if this had anything to do with the way the brain changes function over time.
Yeah, great, great, great question. Very, very interesting line of new information is this epigenetics. And Ginger?
Yeah, it's really pretty amazing that it's turning out that our experience and our environment actually does turn on and off genes. And in terms of the brain, one of the things that Nobel Prize winning winner Eric Kandel, who's the biggest researcher in memory probably that we have, he showed early on that even in the sea snails that genes were being turned on and off in the neurons as a part of making memories. So I would say that we are probably going to learn even, you know, a lot bigger stuff about these influences in the future. I mean, we even know already that just different parts of the brain have different genes turned on and off normally, and we don't know exactly why. That's why the Allen Institute for the Brain is trying to map the human cortex to figure out where the various genes are turned on. And then from there, you know, that's going to make a database for people to study this kind of stuff. So it's a really exciting area.
Would this apply to some future treatments for things like addiction?
It certainly could, but I think it's way too early to try to come up with. We have to understand how it works a little bit better first, I think. But it certainly is an area that people are really excited about, especially clinicians.
the complexity that this throws into our understanding of even the basic metabolic processes is what we've got to get away from. I mean, we're so used to thinking if we do this, then this, then this, then this, some linear thing happens. And really, there's if we do this, 10 other things happen, which reflect on 15 other processes. So, yeah, we're understanding that the environment impacts these genes, but what's the downstream effects is going to be, I mean, it's going to take some serious supercomputing, I think, to figure that.
Yeah, and then the other thing is the whole idea of the so-called personalized medicine that people hope will come out of say, having knowing your genome. The thing is, say you had your genome sequenced, you still wouldn't know which genes were on and which ones were off.
Yeah. I mean, we know things like I have a big interest in asthma. We know people in different parts of Algeria, whether you're in the city, if you're out in the country, if you live a nomadic life, different genes that will affect how your lungs function are turned on depending on where you live. I mean, these things are very clear now. What it all means, I don't know yet.
But it's exciting. And it is. It's an exciting time to be around science.
Okay. Peter, thanks for your call. It's a very, very interesting question and very complex, I think.
I'm glad he brought it up because we wouldn't have gotten to it.
Yep, it's a good one. Thank you. Ginger, we've got a couple of minutes. I want to give you a chance to maybe wrap up. I've heard you do this on your podcast, and I like the idea. Anything in particular you want to leave us with, thinking about in the last minute or so here?
Well, it's never too late to learn something new. And if you've got something that you've got a problem with, instead of trying to avoid it, the research is if you work on it, it can get better. But if you avoid it, you know, that's not going to help.
You're not helping the plasticity. You're not
you're getting ruts in the wrong place.
Yeah. So reinforcing children's efforts at problems rather than providing the answer is also helpful, I'm assuming.
I would say so, yeah.
I've seen that written about helping kids learn new things. Well, what's next for you? What you doing?
Well, next week I'm going to be recording an interview for next month's Brain Science podcast, which is going to be on the subject of glial cells, which glial cells are the other cells in the brain. They outnumber neurons, maybe 10 to 1, and traditionally we've always kind of thought of them as just the glue guys, the guys that were holding everything together, and it's turning out that they are doing some exciting, amazing things. So I'm looking forward to that interview and then sharing it with my listeners.
Well, I want to say thanks very much for taking the time out of your obviously very, very busy day-to-day activity, and hopefully you learned something new and we stimulated a few neurons to do something different today for all of us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Remember, Line One's going to return next week, and we'll be interviewing journalist Judith Warner. Judith is an author of a New York Times bestseller of We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. What she did is she looked into the idea that American children are being over-medicated for depression, anxiety, ADHD, autism, and this illness called bipolar illness in childhood. If you want to know what she discovered and her search to find out what was real and what's not real, you need to join us next week. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.